They can interfere with anyone's ability to use space. The country of Ecuador. They launched their first satellite a few years ago, and within almost immediately, it was taken out by a piece of debris.
Pilots. You are the Empire's strength. We do not accept defeat.
Hello and welcome to Hey Lesson, the podcast where we ask clever people silly questions about video games, the goal being to learn things by mistake. In this episode, we're talking about the laser-saturated space combat of Star Wars Squadrons, and we're going to ask if there is any truth at all to the idea of having a big war in space. Keep listening, and you'll hear from a bona fide space diplomat. At least that's what I'm calling our expert this week. She is a political scientist whose job it is to keep war in orbit as far as possible from the minds of national leaders. But before that, we have a guest on to help us learn about Star Wars Squadrons itself. Say hello to Eurogamer reporter Emma Kent.
Hello.
How are you? How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I've kind of spent about a week in VR, so reality is a little bit distorted for me now. I kind of feel like I'm in the Star Wars universe as a pilot. But yeah, I'm surfacing back in now. It's all good.
Are you a big Star Wars fan, or like just a things in space fan in general?
Star Wars fan for sure. Like literally years now. Like I remember in the playground, just like really getting into it, and then ever since then, it's been like all the films and. You know, like playing Star Wars The Old Republic as well. I love that because of all of the stories in it.
That's the old school RPG one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the MMO.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I played it as a single player game, basically, because you could do that. You just get away with like ignoring everyone else.
But this game, this new one, Star Wars Squadrons, is not really like that. You reviewed it for Eurogamer. Can you explain to any estranged Star Wars fans exactly what Star Wars Squadrons is?
Yeah, for sure. So it's part multiplayer and part story campaign, and the campaign's kind of about 10 hours long, 8 to 10 hours, depending on how good you are. And it's set after the Battle of Endor, so like the second Death Star. So like the Empire is kind of significantly weakened, and then the New Republic is starting to build itself. And I'm going to have to give away a bit about the prologue, because otherwise I won't be able to talk about anything.
That's fine.
Basically, the New Republic is building a new weapon, because it's Star Wars, and that's what happens in every story apparently, and to do that they're kind of using old Star Destroyer scraps to create this big ship, and obviously the Empire doesn't want them to do that. So you've got these two opposing squadrons, Vanguard Squadron on the New Republic side and Titan Squadron on the Empire side, and you kind of alternate between them for various chapters, and there's like a personal battle going on between the leaders, because one of them defected from the Empire. And then the other one is like resentful of that because she was under his kind of tutorage when he defected, and then she got punished for it. And the character you play you don't really say much, to be honest. You kind of just watch what the other characters are doing and participate in blowing various things up over space battles.
So you're not walking around with a lightsaber. Like, this is not an adventure game like the most recent one.
Definitely not.
You're in the cockpit of a spaceship, right?
Exactly, yeah. And actually, there's no walking in the entire game because they've basically designed it for VR. And if you walk around with VR, that is like a disaster for nausea. So you kind of teleport between the rooms and then stand there and people talk at you. And then you go in the cockpits and just fly around and do starfighting. And it's mainly in space as well. Like Motive Studios, who made this, were trying to separate it from the Battlefront games, which are a bit more like planet side and boots on the ground kind of thing. This is very much space battles, like on a big scale. And then 5v5 dogfighting, which is what the multiplayer is about.
The multiplayer, is that a bigger component of the game than the single player? Or if I didn't really like multiplayer games, is this going to be for me?
I'll be honest. I thought the story was okay. It's very good at the kind of immersion side of things. But basically, because of where it's set in the Star Wars universe, I think they were kind of constricted with what they could do in terms of like the stakes. And then beyond that, I think a lot of the characters just kind of like fade into the background and you're a bit like, oh, okay, that's just like a generic fighter pilot or whatever. A couple of them are like interesting and you're like, oh, okay, that's a cool conversation telling me about the lore. But I think the multiplayer is actually really good and where like the kind of heart of the game is. And it's a bit messy. Like there's definitely problems with it. There's been some bugs on launch, but it's just got it's just really gripping. I don't know why. It's just, I think mastering the controls at first is kind of a bit daunting, and then you kind of get to grips with it, and then you start doing like really difficult stuff like space drifting. So The controls are based around shifting your power in your ship between the engine and weapons and shields. And you can learn how to space drift by putting all the power on, like, the engines and kind of cussing out the engines as you turn and things like that. And obviously you apply all of that to a battle situation, either in, like, dogfights, which is 5v5, just shoot as many as you can, or fleet battles, which is a little bit more complicated and strategic. You have to kind of destroy the other team's ship, their big star destroyer or whatever. And to do that, you need bombers, you need support ships, you need good communication with the squad. So yeah, that is where it gets more interesting for me, I think. And you actually need really good squad communication to do that. Otherwise, everyone just goes in as like a TIE interceptor or whatever and tries to dogfight in the middle.
So it's more war among the stars, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. No, it's not subtle at all. It's a lot of dogfighting, but that's fine. I like that, so.
In our world, there are no X-Wings, there are no TIE fighters. We have to make do with satellites and space stations and rockets and stuff like that. But we wanted to know if space war was inevitable. Like, are we going to see Earth countries fighting each other in space? To that end, we spoke to Victoria Sampson of the Secure World Foundation. She's basically part of a group who keep an eye on what various militaries of the world are up to when it comes to space. So let's hear from her about how space war really is a cause for concern.
I can't shake them! Giving engines full power!
So, Victoria, first of all, can you tell our listeners who you are and what you do for a living?
My name is Victoria Sampson. I'm the Washington Office Director of the Secure World Foundation. We try and work as an organization to promote policies and best practices that allow space to be accessible to and usable for all over the long term. So, you know, things like you don't want, you know, satellites cluttering up orbits. You don't want trash being created in space. You don't want people shooting at each other's satellites. You don't want interference, you know, broadcasting interference, that sort of thing.
So you're a professional knower of space.
I am a political scientist by training. I am not a space scientist. But yes, I mean, there are a lot of policy issues involved in space. I think people tend to, you know, think about space solely as rockets and engines, and clearly that's a crucial part of that. But if you don't have the policy and legal decisions behind, you know, the technology, you can't use it. So that's where I like to think we come in.
The Empire chose to destroy Alderaan in order to spread fear and douse the fires of rebellion.
That's good. That's good for what we want to discuss. As you know, we're going to discuss video game Star Wars Squadrons, which is about space politics of a sort.
Sure.
How far are we from seeing people shooting at each other in space with laser cannons?
A ways away. I mean, here's the deal. I think I grew up with Star Wars, and so I think, like most people, that has shaped how I would envision battles being held in space. You can't actually have fireballs in space. You need to have air for there to be fire. So that's your first problem. And then I think the next thing is people tend to think, okay, we're going to see basically the equivalent of fighter jets having battles up in space. And again, that's nowhere near what we talk about when we talk about interference with space capabilities. It's nowhere near as sexy. I mean, it's basically the idea of interference, but that's like radio frequency, like jamming or that sort of thing. That's really where we're at. There are no plans to have Starship Troopers in space, as far as I know. Again, if you see the U.S. Space Force commercials, you might think otherwise.
I see my country finding new horizons out there, and I see giant leaps making a comeback.
There has been discussion about satellites being able to target each other. And so I think that's probably the closest thing that you're talking about, Brendan, in terms of, you know, laser cannons. But again, not as exciting. These are things like satellites looking at each other and trying to figure out, okay, what sort of capabilities does the other satellite have? Who are they broadcasting to? There has been some discussion about possibly interfering on from a physical perspective, you know, like arms reaching out and undoing the other satellite, but we have not seen anything like that in orbit.
What would a warlike incident or an act of war in space even look like?
You raise a very good question, Brendan, because We actually, the international community has not figured out what that would be. There have been no red lines, you know, drawn in terms of like what war would be in space. And for a very long time, actually, it was kind of thought that, you know, satellites don't have mothers. That was the thinking, right? And so it would be less escalatory. It'd be less likely to lead to conflict if you targeted satellites. But the problem is that satellites serve a very distinct purpose, not just for national security, but for economic stability, how our society functions. And so there is a concern that any interference with the satellites working could lead to some sort of conflict. There's a whole school of thought called international humanitarian law, basically the law of armed conflict. How does that apply to space? And there are all sorts of discussions going on, and we just have not sorted that out.
Get ready.
Let them have it.
So what would the nightmare scenario be, however unlikely?
For me, I think a nightmare scenario would be where there's unintentional interference, but it's misinterpreted and it leads to a conflict, whether it's on the ground or in orbit. You know, something like maybe there's a solar flare, for example, that accidentally fries a satellite instrument. And it happens at a time where there's increased hostilities between two countries on the ground. Let's pull two countries at random. Let's say U.S. and China, for example. And so we misinterpret that satellite not working as being deliberate attack by the Chinese. And then we respond either in kind or even, you know, escalate things a little bit. I think that definitely there's that possibility.
All stations, fire on that ship!
Space is a shared resource, right? Like, no country owns space, right? Right?
Right. There are very few treaties involved in this issue, but there's the Outer Space Treaty, 1967, which basically says, like, no one can appropriate space. Space belongs to everyone. And so the question is, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that everyone gets to, you know, free ride up to space? Does everyone get to own the space orbit over them? Some countries on the equator try to argue that they own the satellite slots above them just by sheer dint of it's above them, whether it's, you know, 30,000 kilometers or not. So that there's a lot of nuance involved in that.
I assume then there are a lot of space laws that will stop countries from acting in kind of aggressive ways.
You would think that, but no. Unfortunately, there's four treaties that deal with space issues specifically. The Outer Space Treaty, which is nine articles long, basically it's nine paragraphs. Like, it's not super long in terms of treaty. And then you have, you know, treaties about registering satellites, about liability, you know, astronaut return, that sort of thing. The Outer Space Treaty does have one clause that deals with security issues, and it says you cannot put weapons of mass destruction in orbit or on the moon. I mean, essentially, you know, weapon of mass destruction is a nuclear weapon. It doesn't really say anything about military use of space, and that was done specifically because, you know, I mean, the whole space age was kicked off because of superpower competition. Like, it always had a military element to it.
Making my attack run now.
Let's make this count.
What I've taken from that is, yes, nations are quietly militarizing space in a subdued way, but no nukes on the moon.
Yeah, let me just correct you on that. Space has been militarized from the very beginning. The question is, has it been weaponized?
Ah, okay.
So whether you're launching a missile at a satellite, whether you're trying to, you know, broadcast radio frequency interference, that whole field is called counter-space capabilities. You know, the U.S., Russia, China, we've all developed those counter-space capabilities. We've all tested them. This is not new. But there's a couple things that are new. France has talked about putting lasers on satellites, which is a whole, yeah, that's a whole conversation of itself.
Those are presumably not the kind of pew-pew lasers that the Star Wars squadrons will have, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately nothing near that exciting. When the French, as the Minister of Defense, talked about it, she did talk about having, you know, lasers on microsatellites, which I'm not a scientist, but even from my very basic knowledge of the science, it's almost technically infeasible. What I think they're really talking about is the idea of having small satellites that can look at potentially threatening satellites, you know, get do close approach, that sort of thing. And then just ground-based lasers that could either jam, blind, or temporarily dazzle other country satellites or other space user satellites.
Shields are disabled.
In the video game, you have a fighter ship that has the ability to jam the electronics of other enemy ships, and that's something you've mentioned. Jamming or spoofing GPS information. In reality, is that something that you have to worry about?
Oh, that jamming absolutely happens now. Everyone has that capability. Everyone does it. We see that happening in conflicts now. It is actively being used because it's perceived as not being that threatening in terms of escalating things further. And frankly, it's extremely useful as a tool in combat. Jamming is there. And so definitely jamming communications, jamming position, navigation, timing, like the GPS jamming you mentioned, that happens. Those are all things that are extremely useful. And that we do. And so from a policy perspective, it's concerning just because, as I said before, you don't really have any red lines. Like, at which point is it perceived as being so threatening that you need to respond with some sort of, you know, kinetic strike?
Jamming the enemy. Sensors can't spot you.
And when you say kinetic strike, what do you mean by that?
Kinetic strike, basically, you know, having a missile launch or dropping a bomb or basically anything that's a physical entity you're using to use as a weapon.
And has there ever been any incident that has involved like a physical weapon, for instance, like a missile being fired at a satellite or anything like that? Has that ever happened?
There have been missiles fired at satellites, but they've always been from the satellite owners as part of a test. Basically, the U.S. has done that sort of test where you launch a missile from the ground at a satellite. The Chinese have done it. The Indians did it last year. The Russians have tested something like that in a similar capacity. So basically, those four countries have done that type of actual test. No one has actually used an anti-satellite weapon in any kind of hostile conflict or against another person's satellite yet.
Light them up! Nice!
Presumably that causes like a lot of debris in orbit and junk to fly around. Isn't that dangerous?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, you know, as you go further out in orbit, stuff stays up there longer. If you have a test that's pretty close to where space starts, i.e. 100 kilometers, I mean, that stuff's going to re-enter pretty quickly. And even up to maybe 500 kilometers, it's down pretty soon. But once you get to a certain point, it's going to be up there for years, decades, possibly centuries. At those orbits, they're going at pretty fast speeds. And so even a small piece of debris can be very damaging, if not mission-ending, for a satellite. India had their anti-satellite test last year in 2019, and at the time they said, hey, look, we did this in a fairly responsible manner as far as you can do these things. We did it at a low altitude. We did it at an angle where the debris is going to come back down pretty quickly. You don't have to worry about it. It'll be all be back down within 45 days. And that actually was not the case. I mean, it created maybe 100 plus pieces of debris, and we're still tracking about a dozen, roughly. We're still tracking pieces of debris from that to today. So that was, you know, a year and a half ago. And so that's why there's a real concern about, you know, these tests. It's not just, okay, they could interfere, you know, in terms of a conflict with my abilities to use space. They can interfere with anyone's ability to use space. I always talk about the country of Ecuador. They launched their first satellite a few years ago, and within almost immediately, it was taken out by a piece of debris.
Yeah, and if you're a small country like Ecuador, having big countries batter each other and cause a lot of space litter is not really going to be very helpful for you. So,
absolutely, yeah. These countries are, you know, basically innocent bystanders.
We've lost our capital ships.
A lot of people listening up until now might have been thinking, you know, Star Wars, space war. You know, that's cool. It sounds very cool. It sounds very sci-fi. But it's still war, and war isn't good. It results in a lot of suffering. So what is the best way, from your perspective, to stop space war from breaking out?
That's a very good question. We haven't solved it yet. There will be no silver bullet in terms of how do you prevent war from happening, you know, in space or happening on the ground extending to space. But there's different ways in which you can try and mitigate that. You can try and have agreed upon responsible behavior, right? Because right now, if a country does something that is weird in orbit, unless they put a weapon of mass destruction in orbit or, you know, that sort of thing, you really can't criticize them because what rule are they breaking? There's no actual rules up in orbit. So the idea you try and say, okay, we'll have these international discussions and we'll try and say, okay, this is what a responsible space actor does. And then you can have ways of verifying behavior in orbit. You have, you know, radars, telescopes that are monitoring what's happening in orbit. And that way you can say, okay, I saw this country doing something strange and here's the proof of them doing it. So that's another option as well.
Titan 3, take out those fighters.
Understood. I'll handle it.
In Star Wars, the conflict is very much black and white. There's a bad empire and there's a good rebellion. But conflicts and relationships between nation states on Earth is far more complex. Who then do you think is likely to be the most combative space actor, as you would put it? Like, who seems to be puffing their chests out a lot?
I would say US, Russia, and China are the major ones that are A, developing these capabilities, but B, really finally talking about them more. And then, so you have the U.S. saying this, you have U.S. developing a space force and standing back up at Space Command. And then you have, you know, Russia and China doing their own thing. And I always say that, you know, even though space is a vacuum, the politics do not occur in one. And so you really have to look at, okay, what's happening on the ground? How are these countries interacting? And that's going to shape, and that's going to, I think, affect how you view what they're doing in orbit. You know, for example, with China, anytime China does anything, the U.S. Media goes nuts. You know, when the U.S. does something, the Russian and Chinese media come, you know, talk about it. And, you know, the thing that's been really interesting for me is seeing how much the discussion of Chinese lunar plans have been used as evidence that they want to have, you know, the moon as the ultimate high ground. Whereas whatever the United States does, well, hey, that's just, you know, natural, and we're a scientific mission, you know, NASA this, human exploration that. But when the Chinese do it, it's seen as extremely pointed at the United States and military nature.
Vengeance will be ours.
You mentioned there briefly this new U.S. branch, the Space Force. Are they a precursor to the space fighter pilots of Star Wars? I mean, what do they do? I don't even know.
See, and that's on them. That's not on you.
Thank you.
It's really not very exciting. So they're trying to basically organize everything from a bureaucratic level. That's my perspective. Because it used to be like 60 organizations in the U.S. military that had some sort of say in space capabilities and space investment and space usage. And so the idea is that they wanted to get it all in one institution monitored by the Space Command. But of course, that's not how it's perceived, right? As you said, it's perceived as, you know, we're basically developing our own Starship Troopers. But that's definitely not what's happening.
Five pilots.
One squadron.
The galaxy's finest.
I guess, finally, just to round things off, ultimately, why is it important to stop space war from happening?
I think it's really important to make sure that space doesn't become a place where things are weaponized and where war happens. Just because we get so much benefit from space, we use it to communicate, we use it for banking, we use it to keep an eye on disasters, we use it to share information all the way around for how our culture functions, how our economies function, and, you know, how our national security functions. And so it is part of how we as a society work. And so it's going to be complicated, but I don't think it's definite that it has to become a place where war happens. We have a chance to get out ahead of this. And I think if we approach it in a shared cooperative fashion, which it is possible for that to happen, we can avoid war in space.
Victoria Sampson, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Brendan.
That was political scientist Victoria Sampson. If you want to hear the full interview with her, where she talks a lot more about space war than we squeezed in here, you can hear that by subscribing to our Patreon. It's $2 a month, and it lets you hear all the interviews that we do with our experts. They're completely unabridged, so much longer than that 15 minutes that we inserted there. Go to patreon.com/hairlesson or check the link in the show notes, and you too can become one of our fact rats, which is a term of endearment, I promise. All right, Emma, having listened to Victoria tell us all about the dangers of conflict in orbit, are you still thrilled by the idea of war in space?
I mean, it's a lot less exciting than Star Wars, which have you believe. It's a lot more about, yeah, just unmanned satellites and the threats that they can pose. And that's definitely not like, oh yeah, pew pew with a big gun, which is probably a good thing, to be honest. I'm not sure how I would feel about everyone getting into big spaceships and heading off to their deaths in space. So at least we can kind of just argue about satellites instead.
Do you think it's something that a lot of people think about, even, like that this is a new theatre of war? Or is it just considered so far-fetched that most people on Earth probably don't care?
Well, yeah, this is the interesting thing, actually. And I mentioned to you, Brendan, but I studied a little bit of international security at university, and I remember some of the more modern theories in this go into stuff like pandemics and space security. And it was always kind of framed as like the things that would never happen. And yet here we are in 2020, and governments don't really want to think about stuff that isn't immediate. And also people as well, the same. I think it's just a human condition to not really think about threats until they're almost imminent. And I think this is why it's going to be a problem to actually get governments to act on this, because when there's like a big, you know, like pandemic preoccupying the world and we're going, oh, hang on, look at satellites. It's going to be difficult to get the attention of people who are already kind of stretched, looking at a lot of other resource things. But really, they should be looking at it.
If there wasn't a big pandemic on, certain governments would probably be very interested in getting a step ahead of another government. So do you feel like space war is going to happen eventually?
Ooh, yeah, I think it's probably going to be like a mini version of the Cold War, in that people will kind of have a panic because they'll see other people starting to arm their satellites as like a preventative measure, and then they'll go, oh, hang on, if they've got something on their satellite to take out other satellites, maybe I need to put something on my satellite to prevent them from taking out my satellite. And then before you know it, you end up with a lot of people who have kind of the capabilities to like take out other satellites, or and it's just like an increase in tension that you don't really want. And then at that point, I think we might be more likely to actually see people take it seriously. Yeah, it's basically like a security dilemma in space.
It's like, what was it? Space Race, but Space Race 2.
Yeah, exactly. I think it won't be as worrying as when people were talking about nukes being on satellites and stuff like that, which is when the kind of the original treaty to deal with space kind of came about. It was like in the 60s, in the kind of height of Cold War, when people were seriously worried that there are going to be nukes flying over their heads, and they're like, okay, hang on, that's a little bit too much. We don't really want that. Maybe we should not do that. So yeah, we won't have that, but it could definitely be a problem. And I think something that actually scares me more, that maybe Star Wars doesn't really cover because it's about two sides clashing in like a big war, it's like the impact of private parties and like, you know, capitalism, and like what happens when people start putting loads of satellites in space and there's not the regulation there to make sure that they're doing it appropriately. We know that like SpaceX and Amazon are already doing these big kind of almost like constellations of satellites, which create global internet. And that's great for people down on the ground. But what happens if we start having problems with debris and they're taken out, or they increase the chances of debris in orbit and things like that? So that's something that Star Wars doesn't really cover, again, is third party interests and like private sector, apart from in Last Jedi maybe.
I guess the closest we came to that is like the Trade Federation. Is that, are they a capitalist entity in Star Wars?
Yeah, perhaps that famously thrilling film about trade politics. I quite liked it, but I'm a nerd, so it's fine.
It's interesting that you bring up like the private companies and their place in it, because Victoria did speak to me about it. I think I edited it out in that small segment just for time, but she was talking about that. So it's good to hear that at least you're clued up on it. I didn't know anything about this.
Yeah, no, I'm always most worried about the private sector. Just never know what they're gonna do next. Yeah, and I guess another thing that Star Wars doesn't really discuss is kind of like the impact of like hacking and cybercrime. What happens if satellites start getting hacked and held to ransom, or used to crash into each other? and things like that, because that apparently there was a rumor that that did happen in 1999 to the British government, that a satellite was hacked, and like the Ministry of Defence denied it. But a newspaper came out with a report saying that someone has hacked it and held it to ransom. And that is quite far off, I think, but it is something that could happen. And that's probably, again, more likely than any gun wars that we would see in Star Wars.
Are you disappointed then that real space militarization lacks the glamour of X-Wings and so forth?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, no, not really, because actually war is bad. So I'd prefer it to be in the films. there's something more comforting about seeing like a physical threat than being like, oh, there's this unknown space phenomenon that could happen. You know, like the Kessler effect, which is the theory that all the debris could kind of keep crashing into each other and it spirals out of control, like in gravity.
Oh my god, what?
Yeah, no, that's like an actual theory that obviously they can't prove it yet, but they're worried that it will just, if there's enough debris in orbit, stuff will start crashing into each other and it will keep doing that. And then some bits of orbit will be like off limits to satellites.
What did you call it?
The Kessler effect, I think it was.
That's worrying.
Kessler syndrome or Kessler effect. Yeah, just checking I got it right. But yeah, a theoretical scenario that we don't know whether or not it could happen yet.
To go to the video game for a second, what was the most memorable moment that you had flying through the game?
Well, probably actually just flying through a debris field.
Just the Kessler, the thing that you just described.
Well, actually, the debris doesn't really... it's quite static in the game. You kind of fly into the debris. There's not really anything moving in the environment, which is good, because I think I wouldn't be able to deal with that if there were like asteroids actually kind of like moving out of place. But I was chasing a capital ship through like a debris field, and it was just this kind of very organic, or maybe just like cleverly done moment where I realized that I was chasing like the ship through like a giant old bit of debris and managed to like hunt them down and shoot it inside. And I was like, oh wow, this is cool. Basically, I think the whole experience of playing that in VR as well has been particularly mind-blowing. I really did feel like I went to space for a few days, and it's kind of hard to describe. I think you get a sense of like the enormity of the ships and just like the scale of these things, and also the debris fields. It's also really beautiful. I just parked my ship in like the practice mode and just had a look around, and I was like, this is really nice. And just listening to the beeping of the ship, there's no battles going on, I'm just chilling out here. So maybe the best bit of the game is the bit where there's no war.
Oh, that's actually nice sentiment, isn't it?
Yeah. Maybe space is better if we don't fight each other.
Is there a noticeable difference between the spaceships in the game? Did you end up favouring one over any of the others?
Oh, for sure. So I'm a big fan of the TIE Interceptor, which is like the really fast but kind of fragile ship on the Empire side. Yeah, you have to be careful with it. You can't go ploughing in front of these big capital ships because you'll just get blasted away. But it's really good fun for chasing people. And the thing that stands out to me about the multiplayer is like the kind of psychological mind games you play with people. And particularly when it's just you and one other person and you're both trying to chase each other and find out a way to kind of get around the other person and shoot them. And you get quite a lot of that with the Interceptor. But I do also quite like playing as the support ships. They have some interesting mechanics on them, so you can like heal other people, or you can like target enemies so that they're weaker and your teammates will find it easier, or use the iron cannons to disable them. And that's quite good fun, although you are an easy target and you have to rely on your squad mates a bit to like help you out. And that's not always the easiest if you're playing with complete strangers. But yeah, if you've got friends, support ships, pretty good fun.
Do you think we'll ever get like space fighter jets like this? Or is that a stupid thing to think? I'm just hopeful. I'm just asking hopefully.
You just really want to. I don't think so. I feel like we'll get some very kind of advanced planes and things like that. And then also, I guess, drones. It's probably the closest we're going to get to anything like this. I did do a bit of research before going on to see if anyone had actually developed a proper space weapon like the sort that we've seen. And I do know that apparently the Soviet Union created a cannon to put on their space station in the Cold War.
What?
And they did fire it. Yeah, no, so, yeah, it can't have been very good because the results of this test are classified and the gun was kind of never seen again, and obviously it was, like, not good. But, yeah, there was an article, I think the gun, like, appeared on Soviet TV a few years ago, and then someone wrote an article about it where they, like, made a 3D model of what it would look like.
That's amazing.
By Popular Mechanics, and they found out that So it was fired in 1975, and they had to get everyone off the space station because they were so worried that it would rattle the station and with all the astronauts inside, that's not a good idea to test this cannon. And apparently they had to move the entire 20-ton space station around to aim it. So you couldn't just move the cannon. You had to angle the entire space station in the direction you wanted to fire. Yeah, well, I think they were worried about American satellites or space stations potentially coming to do an inspection. So apparently it was a self-defense thing because they were genuinely worried about protecting their space property. So apparently that's what it was for, and they did not stick around. It can't have been that good.
Do they know what they shot at in the test, Ron, or...?
I think they literally just shot 3 rounds that kind of burned up in the atmosphere.
They just shot it at the ground.
I'm not sure which direction they fired it in, because it was in orbit. So I'm sure they probably just spun it towards space and fired it or something. I'm not sure.
That would be irresponsible, surely.
Just fire it at the ground. Well, we know that people are a bit irresponsible with their space tests, it seems, so.
That's true. That's very true. Did you see the Space Force adverts that Victoria was talking about?
I actually didn't, but I can see why people get the wrong idea of a Space Force. The name does not make it sound like the actual very boring bureaucratic thing it is.
There's something strangely sci-fi movie about them. It feels like they're basically a relocate to Mars advert in Blade Runner or something.
Oh gosh.
You should check them out.
Yeah.
I'm going to put a link to them. Victoria also talked about the laws governing space or international agreements like treaties and stuff. You can't put a weapon of mass destruction in orbit, for example. You can't put a nuclear weapon in orbit or on the moon or things like that. Do you reckon the Star Wars universe would benefit from a similar set of treaties?
I mean, they did try. The Senate did not work, as we found out in the kind of films. It became hijacked by fascists and then became the Empire. So I don't know what that says about...
That wouldn't happen. That wouldn't happen. Come on.
Oh, no, we've fascists? Never seen that happen before. Oh, gosh. Yeah, I think it definitely makes sense to get these agreements in place before the problems crop up. It seems like an easy win, but I'm not sure whether the big powers are all going to be in agreement to kind of sign away their rights to experiment in space. And even if they do sign up to it, you sometimes wonder if people are going to stick to it and who's going to enforce the rules. There's lots of problems with it, but it's definitely something you should try to do. Lord knows what else is going to work. Unless we have space police.
I don't know, that's a whole other problem, probably.
Yeah. Well, maybe the Empire is the space police.
If you could sit down with the New Republic of Star Wars and their enemies, the remnants of the Imperial Navy, and hash out an agreement that would make a space diplomat like Victoria Sampson proud, what would you include in that agreement? I'm asking you as a knower of these things.
Gosh, well, I guess you'd probably try to agree for both sides to kind of disarm themselves slowly over time and agree to be okay, we're going to limit ourselves to this many starfighters. And the New Republic would probably have to agree to stop creating massive ships out of Star Destroyers. Although I feel like it would be hard to convince them of that because the Empire had already built 2 Death Stars by then, and they're kind of a bit hang on, we need something to defend ourselves with here. Otherwise they're just going to do a 3rd one. Which, funnily enough, they do! Who knew? So, oh gosh, it just goes on and on, doesn't it? But yeah, it would be a difficult one for sure. But yeah, definitely a slow kind of de-escalation, I think. I don't think you could solve it with one treaty.
So limits on space weapons, space fighters, large cannons in space, anything else?
Gosh, I'm trying to think if there's anything particularly nasty.
No blowing up planets.
Yes, I think that's definitely no civilian casualties, because the Empire, once again, is fine with doing that, apparently, in this game. Yeah, they're just we'll just blow them up, it's fine.
No draining suns of their energy.
Yeah, no kind of destruction of people's solar property, I guess. I guess it's difficult as well because the New Republic, I guess, by that point, it's got to be a bit more responsible. It's not the Rebellion anymore. It's got to actually be accountable for what it's doing. With the Rebellion, it's a bit they're just hiding amongst people. They're not really kind of a proper organisation, a formal one. Yeah, I guess no big tractor beam ships. It's what they would have to agree to.
All right, finally, after having played a good chunk of the new Star Wars game, Star Wars Squadrons, would you recommend it to people as a method of slaking their bloodthirst for space war, perhaps.
Oh my goodness. I did develop a lot of bloodthirst playing this game. Really worrying. I kind of like a greyhound or something. Once I like lock on to an enemy, it's like, I am going to get you. And I go to chase you for 5 minutes until I get you.
Oh my word.
It's not always the best for like the team, but it's really good fun. But yeah, so yeah, if you're a bloodthirsty person, I guess that's a good place to get that out in space where you can't hurt anyone, apparently.
That is all we have time for, I'm afraid. You've been listening to Hey Lesson with me, Brendan Caldwell, and our guest this time, Emma Kent. A massive thanks to you for coming on, Emma.
Oh, no worries. It's great fun.
Where can people find you on the internet?
Well, obviously, I'm writing for Eurogamer, so you can check Eurogamer out. And my Twitter handle is @GonnyFK.
If you have enjoyed this episode, listener, please consider supporting us. You can throw a couple of dollars our way on Patreon. You get extra goodies, including access to full interviews with the experts that we interview, like I've mentioned. But also you get bonus episodes and video updates from us. Head to patreon.com/heylesson, and you will also get to just enjoy supporting a show that doesn't have any ads or sponsors. We only need our listeners' support. We don't need that ad money. If you have any suggestions, feedback, you can email us. Please give us some stars on iTunes. It really helps us to get spotted by more people. If you like the show, tell people you like the show, please. We're very young, but for now, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Emma as well. Thank you very much.
No time to celebrate. Move on.